You're listening to Section D, first broadcast on the 5th of January 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and a very warm welcome to a bright-eyed January look-ahead edition of Section D, Monocle's dedicated design show. I'm your host, Josh Fennett. On today's show, I'm joined in studio by Monocle's design correspondent, David Pleasant, to mull over the year ahead in architecture, design, and what to expect from the world of fashion.
A sheer quirk of fate. 2016 is going to be the year of a number of biennales and triennales.
That was James Taylor Foster of Arc Daily there. Next up, we head to Rio to talk through a newly opened and tantalizingly entitled museum, the Museum of Tomorrow.
The museum in itself is a symbol inside of this urban renovation that we are doing, leading to the kind of city that we are looking for.
We also stop in Milan to talk about the career of an iconic Dutchman who shaped the city's design for the better. All that to come right here on this special look-ahead edition of Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show. You're listening to Section D with me, Josh Fennett. We recently aired a special edition of The Globalist on Monocle 24, in which I spoke to a few leading lights from the industrial design, fashion and architecture industries in an attempt to augur a few headlines for the year ahead. First up, I was joined by Arc Daily's James Taylor Foster to discuss architecture in 2016.
A sheer quirk of fate. 2016 is going to be the year of a number of biennales and triennales. There's the Venice Biennale, the Oslo Triennale, the first one, the Istanbul Design Biennale, and the Lisbon Triennale. And I think that from my point of view, something interesting is happening. It seems that architecture is kind of being recognized not for icons anymore and the starchitects, while smaller collectives are emerging. And perhaps that's something to do with the themes of all these biennales and triennales coming up in 2016. The Venice Biennale is being curated by a Chilean architect called Alejandro Aravena. He's worked extensively with new models for housing people who have very low incomes. And he's been very successful in Chile in doing it. And he's called his biennale Reporting from the Front. And he's basically asking every single national curator to try and uncover the problems facing each respective country. And I think those problems are very different in, say, for example, Norway, Sweden and Finland to Argentina. They're at different levels of development and they've got different problems to face. And I think it's going to be fascinating from that point of view in teasing out all of these kind of nuances, which the Venice Biennale previously hasn't been able to do. But similarly, the Oslo Triennale, which is one of the first, are examining, it's being organized by the After Belonging Agency, who are a group of people based in New York, who are looking at the challenges of migration. They're looking at the ways people are moving around the world now. Certainly in 2015, we've seen incredible changes in the way people move and way people inhabit countries. And they're asking, you know, where do we really belong? Because architecture it forms our built environment. Architecture is the place in which we all live, and we're all forced to live at different qualities, different levels. But the idea of belonging is a whole other theme entirely.
And that was James Taylor Foster speaking to me a little earlier for our Design Look Ahead show for 2016 on The Globalist. Do check out that and the rest of our Look Ahead shows for the year at monocle.com, SoundCloud or iTunes. But for now, I'm joined in studio by Monocle's very own design correspondent, David Pleasant. You listen to the show. What are you looking forward to for the year, David?
I thought it was fascinating, and especially that from James. So much going on in terms of architecture, and it's extraordinary to talk about triennales. I thought, you know, I was thinking about last time I was in Lisbon, and I can't believe it's 3 years ago, but 3 years does come by that quickly. I really can't wait to go back this year. There is that sort of delicate, slightly slightly old school approach in Lisbon. It's a very kind of intellectual, rigorous approach to architecture. And I think that's why that particular event stands out above any of the others. Although, of course, there is Venice, the Biennale that is the big one. But for me, Lisbon is really something that I can't wait to get on that TAP, that tap plane down to Lisbon for that.
And I hate to be controversial about these things, but, you know, for Monocle, I've spent a bit of time in Oslo. There's a huge reappraisal of the industrial design scene happening there. A lot of, frankly, oil money being pumped into, you know, reevaluating the legacy of these things. But interestingly, you know, Oslo, its urban environment is very particular. So you have the fjord on one side, which is immovable. You have these protected forests on the other. There's a lot of infill architecture. There's a lot of need for interesting architectural solutions, not to mention the fact it's one of Europe's fastest growing cities. Do you hold out much hope in August for a successful architecture triennale there? The first one, the inaugural one, are you excited about that at all?
I am, Josh, because to be honest, last year we saw Chicago Biennale, the first architecture biennale, and there's always a certain amount of scepticism about a new global event like this. We it feels like every city over a million inhabitants has to have some sort of biennale or design festival or week or so on. So there's a certain amount of fatigue. But Chicago proved us all wrong. It was actually a fantastic event, and it still resonates. People are still talking about what happened in Chicago. We obviously covered it on Section D. So why not Oslo? You know, I don't know much about Oslo's architecture. There is a certain amount of design legacy. There are some influential designers that have come out of Norway over the decades. But I think that it's about time that we kind of take stock of Norway. Denmark, Sweden have all had a lot of attention. So why not? I'd be very much up for going up there.
And from the built environment to the products that surround us, next up on the Globalist Design Look Ahead, we spoke to design consultant and editor of Fiera magazine, Katie Tregeddon, about the trends for the year to come.
There were two things, really. One, interestingly, at the end of the Design Academy Eindhoven graduate show, Thomas Wiedershoven, their creative director, highlighted two things that were happening within the university. One was that his students were using incredibly conceptual ideas to sort of tackle the world's problems. No surprise, that's kind of what Design Academy Eindhoven does. But the other one was tactility. And he described tactility as a political statement, a human statement, and a social statement. You know, if you look at the 2015 House of the Year, Flint House, and it's an incredibly tactile piece of architecture. You look at something like Tracy Tubbs' origami wallpaper, sort of interior finishes are incredibly tactile. So it's very much about connecting people closely to real life as a sort of antidote to this sort of virtual life that we're living now. So I thought that was a really interesting trend. And the other piece comes out of what we were just talking about. So it's about identity. And I think people are looking for more of a story in the things they buy. They want pieces that say something about them and about the designers. And the best work that I saw across the four shows had a really strong sense of identity, whether it was in Dubai, whether it was Nova Castron in Newcastle, who make products inspired by the local area, using local craftsmen, using local materials. You know, I think that really strong sense of identity, and often very local identity, and an identity that's born of heritage and history, is what really made the designers stand out across the four shows at the end of this year.
That was the lovely Katie Tregeddon, design journalist, content consultant, and the editor of Fiera magazine, reviewing the last four shows of the trade fair season. I'm joined in studio by our design correspondent, David Pleasant, to talk about what we're looking forward to in the trade show season. Obviously, Maison et Objet in Paris comes up in the third week of January. You and I have covered that before. Will you be going this year? Are you excited about it? What are you looking forward to, David?
It is exciting. I think Maison et Objet has really managed to shine out as the main platform for the smaller objects, as it says on the tin. You know, they're good at displaying wonderful objects to fill your home with. Whereas Milan might kind of encompass the whole design spectrum and is a bit of a behemoth and can be a little bit confusing. I think the nice thing about Paris is it is big, but it's all in one place. And the variety and the kind of global scope of people who are making really good small objects for the home is fantastic. And it's always an exciting place to be. You always get a buzz. I think they've been really good at opening out the fair beyond the Parisian scene and beyond France. It attracts all sorts of designers. They're very good at engaging young, upcoming designers, also artists. There's always the atelier side of the fair. So, yeah, I am excited about it.
And I think one interesting thing for the year to come is Maison et Objet has been fantastically good at, as you mentioned, reaching a wide audience, but also kind of franchising itself in a way that other fairs haven't. I think it's the second installment this May of Maison et Objet Americas, which is in Miami Beach, and who doesn't want an excuse to go to Miami Beach? But also, I think, you know, it's an interesting place for them to be because they have access to the South American market. There's a lot of money in the USA that won't necessarily come over to Paris to spend it. And likewise, 2 years ago, they also started out in Singapore. So I think we'll be dispatching a few correspondents to, you know, deal with the various things that we see there. And then coming up in May, we have Salone del Mobile, of course. Did you have a favourite in the season, David?
Well, I think I'm going to have to wait a little bit until towards the end of the year, until October, until Dutch Design Week. And we actually heard Katie talk about that. I think it's a fantastic event. It's in Eindhoven, which is a smaller city right down in the south of Holland. And I think the way it throws itself into that Design Week is fantastic. There's Philips Light Bulb Factory on the old site of the Philips Light Bulb Factory, which has got this incredible industrial design heritage there. And as she mentioned, you're shuttled around. It's very convenient. And also there's this kind of Dutch culture of design that's really relevant and really sort of, you can really feel it just about everywhere on site. So that's my favourite coming up this year.
And from Dapper Design to the sartorial season, we hear next from Le Figaro's editor-at-large and the roving fashion correspondent, Godfrey Dini, about his picks for the year ahead in fashion.
As the French say, chapeau, hats off to them. They've made a season which now has momentum. Now it looks like it's destined to stay. And now also it's beginning to attract enough buyers to make it self-fulfilling. And I think the web has played a huge role in that because now young designers in London have become, you know, much more famous and have a much bigger reputation, either in terms of men's or women's, from Erdem to Roxanne Ilinich to Peter Pilotto to Simon Rocher, all these people, women designers. I also think men's designers, it's the same, that there are people who now have global reputations thanks to the internet, are very well known in Japan or in China, who a few years ago would have meant absolutely nothing, you know, and I think that's very striking that London has managed to do that.
And that was Godfrey Dini, editor-at-large of Le Figaro. And what an amazing accent he has, David. My favourite thing about that interview is definitely his accent.
Yeah, I know, very husky. Great one there.
A husky Irishman. But he's talking about something which is coming up immediately. I think Friday is the start of London Fashion Week. We are dispatching a few correspondents to do a couple of extra special episodes of Section D from Pitti Uomo in Florence, which happens the following week. But what have you got your eyes on in terms of your clothes for the year to come, David?
Well, I do think it's interesting that everybody, as he mentioned there, everybody's kind of really excited about Balenciaga's new creative director. I'm going to try and pronounce his name right. The Georgian fellow, Denmar Gwasalia, who everybody's waiting for his new collection. There does seem to be this shift away in the luxury sector, away from that sort of raiding the archives of old masters of design, of fashion design, and really striking up something new. And I think people have got sick of that sort of heritage, those brands, and looking at the old collections for inspiration. I think people like this designer are starting to do things very differently, and people really don't know what to expect when they go to these shows. I'm by no means an expert in terms of women's wear and ladies' fashion, but it seems like that sector is reviving itself again, whereas it might have been the men's wear that was sort of like the exciting ground last year and the year before. It's sort of ladies are taking over again now, and fashion is going back to basics in terms of inspiring people and really sort of shocking people as well. Like, no one has any idea what he's going to come up with for this new collection, and I think that's what everyone wants to know, and that's probably going to be the hottest ticket in Paris in March.
I completely agree, and I also get the sense that there's this kind of shift in generations. I mean, you know, Raf Simons has quit, and there is a sort of constant change going on in the fashion world, but actually, is there a new generation of consumers that want something a bit different and want these younger designers to come in? Because this young Georgian pretender, he's under 30, isn't he? Late
20s. He's 34, I believe.
He's 34.
Still pretty young.
Still rather young, and I think that's an interesting kind of shot in the arm for an industry that perhaps needs it, especially when, as I discussed with Godfrey, there's so many collections that these fashion designers have to come up with. There's a cruise mid-season collection, they're making handbags, they're making shoes, and accessories too. And, you know, that's a big problem. And most of these people burn themselves out after a season or two if it's not immediately, you know, the most amazing thing that completely revives a brand that's down at heel. It's an industry we'll be watching with great interest throughout the year. My very special thanks to our design correspondent, David Pleasant, for joining me in studio. Thank you, David.
Join Monocle Films at the Murano Wine Festival, where our roving specialist Marcus Hippie discovers a new generation of South Tyrolean vintners on the high-altitude, sunny slopes of northern Italy.
The last 30 years have been great for South Tyrolean wines, and there is no reason to think that this evolution will end here. With the excitement and passion that now prevails in the region, it is time for South Tyrol to go from the hidden gem of Italian wine to a real jewel in the global crown.
Start the new year with new discoveries. Check out our South Tyrolean wine special in the film section of Monocle.com.
Next up on the show, we head to sunny Rio de Janeiro, which has recently added another museum to its budding cultural scene. The Museum of Tomorrow was opened by President Dilma Rousseff in the Portside Olympic City development, a once-forgotten part of Rio that's in the process of being revitalised. The 15,000 square metre building is designed by Spanish architect Santiago Calatrava and is inspired by the spiky flowering bromeliads found in the city's botanical gardens. Bathed in natural light from its tall windows, the all-white building is made from sustainable materials. Monocle's Rio correspondent Sheena Roster visited the museum to see how this unique place is becoming a symbol for the future of the city.
Crowds gather in Rio de Janeiro's newly renovated Praça Mauá, buzzing around the shiny new Museu de Amanhã, the Museum of Tomorrow. Sitting in the corner of the 34,600 square meter plaza, the Grandioso Science Museum is a gorgeous structure. Standing tall and long, the white structure is made mostly of windows and solar panel beams, and it juts out into the Guanabara Bay. Personally, what I see looks similar to a shark skeleton rather than a flower, but that's just a matter of perspective. Regardless of its looks, the building symbolizes Rio's tomorrow, today.
This museum is a bit different because it is not about answers, but about questions.
That's Alberto Silva, president of the Porto Maravilha Urban Renovation. He's the man overseeing the Porto Maravilha project, the Marvelous Port, which looks to rejuvenate Rio de Janeiro's port area, a part of the city that went decades without any upgrades. Now, City Hall is looking to put in better urban transport networks here, along with making it a more vibrant hub and extension of the city center. Really, the Museum of Tomorrow is just a small piece of the long-term project for the region, as he explains.
The museum in itself is a symbol inside of this urban renovation that we are doing. Because once we have some old buildings that is leading us to our memory, our history, like Art Museum of Rio, we have this building here that is so new, so modern, leading to the other way, to the future, to the kind of city that we are looking for.
How has the Museum of Tomorrow transformed this part of the city that was once dead?
The museum is part of one big process of urban renovation. It will be in the middle of the seafront of Rio, that is a 3.5 kilometers extension. That is a new cultural corridor also. And this museum is just in the middle. It's new, it's a different. And this one is about science, about future, a new subject, and attract more and more people to visit here.
Stepping inside, the museum's contents are just as impressive as the structure itself. Curator Luis Alberto Oliveira tells me about the space he had to work with.
Calatrava was inspired by a flower from the bromelia plant in the Botanical Garden of Rio. So created this modular longilinear structure that keep a set upon a water mirror between two gardens. And this is the main concept of the museum. For holding the content of the museum itself, he offered us this cathedral nave. He says that museums of science are just like the cathedrals of the 21st century. So you have an experience in a cathedral, you have a fantastic atmosphere, very huge volume, and the light comes through the windows, through the glasses on the side, incredible acoustics, the music, fantastic. So you have an experience that you just have there. You're taken away from a common-day perspective and you have an experience that you have nowhere else. That's what you want to have here.
A scientist himself, he seems like the appropriate person to curate this permanent exhibition here. Luis Alberto shows me around.
So where are we going into now?
We're going into the Tomorrow's area, which is the main area of the museum. The area is the goal of the museum. And it is an origami structure which defines two areas, three environments. The first one is society, living together. The next one is planet, living. The further one is human or being.
This is a little game where people can learn what they're doing to contribute to the world.
Yes, this is the ecological footprint game. So you can measure how many planets will be necessary for 7.3 billion people to live just like you live. The way you eat, the way you inhabit, the way you consume, and all that. And this is, we'll be summing up and to make an average of the visitors, how many planets the average of the visitors shall need.
What's the best result that a visitor can get on here?
Less than one planet. And the worst is more than one planet. That is the fact, if you have more than one planet, then we are taking resources from the future, using them today. And we are not leaving the planet the way to regenerate its own resources. So you're in fact consuming to our own body.
We reach a section surrounded by 10-meter-high, 3-meter-wide LED screens, emitting 210 square meters of light. Images of the world's consumption habits, natural disasters, and statistics are blasted across these LEDs.
The fact that now our civilization has become a planetary-wide force of change or transformation, and the consequences of our actions are very long-range. So we were inspired to create a monument. So we have two very, very wide light support. We can show the information about these impacts that we're having upon our environment, upon ourselves.
Showing that this is more than just a good-looking structure, the Museum of Tomorrow's content clearly aims to make visitors more conscious of the impacts of their actions. But with Brazil's currently poor financial and political health, there are concerns that the Museum of Tomorrow, which costs a cool 215 million reais, about 55 million US dollars to build, won't be maintained after the 2016 Summer Olympics roll out of town. Alberto Silva says that won't be the case, though.
The contract to conduct this renovation is signed off in 2011. And run up to 2026. And the funds is already allocated. Yes, it's true, the economy in Brazil is a bit bad now, but in terms of urban renovation or urban development or even real estate market development, this timeline is a bit longer. We are talking about 30 years ahead. I think the Porto Maravilha is showing one way out of the crisis instead of being under risk of that.
From Monocle in Rio de Janeiro, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
Next up on Section D, we're off to Milan to talk graphic design. While the Italian city is already brimming with creatives, we turn our attention to a Dutch-born transplant who wound up leaving a lasting mark with his designs. The late Bob Norder may not be a household name, but the designer was instrumental in bringing about good, simple, and well-conceived design to the public. Thanks to a recent retrospective published by Italy's Moleskin, fans of graphic art can now see the scale of Norda's impact on his adopted homeland. Monocle's Milan correspondent Ivan Carvalho recently caught up with the book's editor Mario Piazza to learn more.
Wander around Milan's streets, and one's eyes can't help but be drawn to this design capital's urban decor. It is marked not only by varying styles of architecture, but by a sea of signage. There are signs and logos for businesses, organizations, and government agencies, many done in striking typefaces and imagery that jump out at the viewer. And many of these bear the mark of Bob Norda, the Dutch designer who called Milan home for over half a century. Now in the book, Bob Norda Design, readers can see the visual legacy he left behind. The book's editor is Mario Piazza.
Bob Norda is recognized by everyone as a great Milanese graphic designer. The reality is that, like many other Milanese graphic designers who founded the Milanese school, he was in fact foreign. Bob was from the Netherlands, and he'd gone to a very serious, high-quality school with a setup like Bauhaus and De Stijl. Fascinated by the idea of going away from the Netherlands to look for a job, he was uncertain as to whether to go to the United States or to Milan, in the end choosing Milan. He arrived there and found himself in a community of foreign people who stayed in Milan because there indeed was a cultural liveliness in the city, propelled towards modernity, design and research. One of these meetings led to a very, very positive start to his career because he immediately became one of Pirelli's graphic consultants.
Uno dei consulenti grafici della Pirelli.
At Pirelli, where he would rise to become art director for the tire maker, Norda helped introduce modern graphic design and the concept of a coordinated image to project to consumers. He was busy with advertising campaigns, brochures, and more for the firm. Mario Piazza.
For Norda, Pirelli was the beginning of a great experience in Italy. Pirelli at the time made tires, like they still do now, but also many other things, everything connected to rubber, from sofas to mattresses to gloves for washing up. He did lots for them, but the one thing where there was continence of vision was to work on the fact that the name of the company itself could become the element of the product that would be recognized. There are some posters where only Pirelli Fasta is written, but the word Pirelli is calendared as if it were a tire. This work was done many times. For example, a black crown with Pirelli, Pirelli, Pirelli written inside it gave the impression of matter, of the physicality of the product. This thing of seeing the brand turn into an object, becoming the product that the consumer recognizes, was one of Norda's great intuitions. Letting us see the idea of movement, letting us see the image of the product, and at the same time saying, this is Pirelli.
Del movimento, farci vedere l'immagine del prodotto, nello stesso tempo dire, questo è Pirelli.
Other corporate clients soon followed, and today Norda's creations can be seen on logos for everything from energy companies to publishing houses to even food packaging for a local supermarket chain. In 1962, he was commissioned to design the decor and signage of Milan's new subway system, which would earn him the prestigious Compasso d'Oro Design Prize.
In Bob's book, he dedicates a great part to this experience because to him, apart from winning the Golden Compass, the Compasso d'Oro, it was a great opportunity and also an experimenting ground. He had this idea to allow all things thought up by architects to become a kind of line which guided the passenger, the user of the vehicle, from the city surface to the underground of the metro. This line was modular. It became the handrail, it became all signage. But mainly, Norda's very intelligent idea was to think that the flow of reading on vehicles creates difficulties in understanding what station you've arrived in, especially on the metro, which has a very high incidence of number of stations compared to a regular train. So his idea was to draw this continuous red line on the platform, a double level, one for usage information, entry and exit to the station, and the other to recognize a station, where the name would be repeated at intervals. This greatly helped usability on the metro.
Questo favoriva tantissimo, no, l'uso del mezzo.
Functionality always came first for Norda. His sharp graphics quickly catch the eye. It was good design that went on to become good business, as he set up graphic agency Unimark with Massimo Vignelli, and they would go on to work with the likes of IBM and the Newark subway system, where his wayfinding signs, like those in Milan, are still used by millions each day to get around. For Monocle, in Milan, I'm Ivan Carvalho.
And sadly, that's all we have time for on this week's show. My thanks to our editor, Alex Funnell, and the show's producers, Henry Rhys Sheridan and David Pleasant. If you have any comments, queries or suggestions, do feel free to drop Henry a note at hrs@monocle.com. You can brush up on our back catalogue or listen again at monocle.com, SoundCloud or iTunes. You've been listening to Section D. I'm Josh Fennett, and until next time, goodbye.